Welcome to From Zero to Millions, Accounting Edition. I am Bilal Mihana.
And I'm Kelly Roars. We're here to share our wealth of knowledge on running a public accounting firm. Whether you're a seasoned CPA, an aspiring accountant, or a business owner seeking financial guidance, join us for valuable insights and practical advice.
Let's dive in. Welcome, guys, to our next episode with Michael Lee from Zero to Millions Accounting Edition. Michael Lee, the CEO of Reconcile.com. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for Bilal having me.
We met through Katie on LinkedIn, and I looked at your background, man. You're an entrepreneur, and I heard a couple of your podcasts before, and you have a great background in accounting. So tell us about your journey through how you started your business, what made you start your own firm, and how you grew it. What was like the secret formula to grow that firm?
Oh, you want to know all the secrets.
Uh-huh.
That's great. I got into accounting because my now brother-in-law was dating my sister at the time. And he was the first person I met that did accounting. I didn't know anybody that studied or did accounting. He was studying accounting in college. So he's dating my sister. And he'd pick me up every summer and we'd go to his office. And I worked on this database for his company. And I would enter in information to this database. I did that for a few summers. And then when I was 16, he had taught me how to do his accounting job. So when he left to go get his master's in accounting, they gave me his job. So that was my first accounting job, was about 16.
Wow.
Yeah. And it wasn't a tax or audit job. It was inside a large nonprofit. But I became their accountant. And from 16 to 19, I did all their accounting on a daily, weekly basis, all the financial reports and everything. I just learned from him. So it was kind of,
through college, you breezed through accounting classes.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. Yeah. And I never wanted to become a CPA, or I don't even have a CPA. I didn't want to go into audit or tax. That wasn't the route. I saw accounting as a skill that I picked up. And then I grew up in a family of entrepreneurs. My parents are both entrepreneurs, and me and my siblings are now all entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. So I knew one day that's the route I wanted to go. I just leveraged accounting to get there.
Interesting.
And so that's kind of the journey. So after college, I spent several years just growing inside companies as a bookkeeper, then a controller, then a CFO. But it was almost all small businesses that I worked in. I didn't really work any large enterprises. It was almost all businesses up to $40, $50 million a year in revenue, starting from zero all the way up to there. And then eventually in 2016, after several years of being a CFO and a fractional CFO to different companies, I decided to launch Reconciled to see if I could expand the services I was offering solo at the time and expand it on a more larger scale. And that's how Reconciled was born.
I like the name, by the way. It's a nice name. Usually it's hard to come up with a name. And most people just, my firm's called Mihana Advisors, because it was hard to come up with a name. You short enough that catches the point. I'm an accountant that is available online. Is your website called Reconciled.com or is it a different domain?
That's the domain. Yeah, reconciled.com. I started out with a different name, reconciledit.com, because that's what I could afford at the time. Reconciled.com wasn't available. It was too expensive to get. And so I did reconciledit.com, got that for 10 bucks, and built a $99 website on my own, launched it. And then it wasn't until 2018, so basically 2.5 years later, when I was able to afford reconciled.com, which I think I got for like $15,000 or something like that.
Wow. So you paid money for that. A lot of accountants won't do, probably.
We're cheap, we're scrappy. And if your goal is basically to build clients in your local community, you really don't need that great of a domain name. Most accounting firms and accountants, it's the last name advisors, last name CPA, last name. But if you're trying to grow and scale a brand, you actually need a good domain. You need a good brand name. And so I felt like the investment for the domain was important.
Are you the brand, or the brand is the company?
Brand is the company. It's definitely not me. Most of my customers have never interacted with me.
But how you came about, because you started as you as a brand. Everyone came to you as because of the accountant. You got the clients. How do you go from where you started, okay, to becoming now the brand as a company, not you?
So yeah, when you first start, like any typical accounting service company or accountant, you're marketing your services. I heavily focused on marketing my services and not marketing Michael. So I heavily focused that on the sales process. So it all starts with the sales process. And then I actually hired a full-time bookkeeper when I launched. And I just was confident in my selling skills and said, okay, as I bring on new clients, I'm not going to be the primary one that does the work. I'm going to pass it on to a bookkeeper. Mm-hmm. Now, if there was CFO work or work the CFO bookkeeper can do, of course, I took that on, right? I did what I could. We didn't offer tax services at the time. I don't have a tax background. Really, it was bookkeeping and advisory or CFO services. So the goal was to sell the service stack and the brand. And if your goal is to grow, you want to sell and present yourself bigger than what you are. So mm-hmm. I wasn't out there saying, hey, I am offering. It really is the language. I am offering. Michael is offering. Here is mm-hmm. my background. Here are my skills. That's what a lot of accountants do. Is yes. their identity and their focus is, I'm an accountant first. That's not mine. My identity and focus is, I'm an entrepreneur first. I happen to offer accounting services, but I could offer marketing services. I could offer HR. I could offer any kind of services. Honestly, if you said, hey, I'm willing to pay you if you go down to Starbucks and grab me a bunch of coffee and mail it to me. Mm-hmm. Hey, if you pay me enough, I'll do it. So that's the focus is I'm a business person first. I'm trying to solve problems. I'm an entrepreneur first. I'm not an accountant first. So I'm not out there selling Michael's skill set, Michael's skills. I happen to have some, but that's not primarily what I was selling. I was selling the reconciled brand, the service stack, the solutions we were offering. And that's what the sales process was focused on.
Interesting. And how did you, so like you started in 16 and 16 yeah. online wasn't like big deal. Like it wasn't like as now, like I get most of my clients, 90% of my clients come through online.
Yeah.
And 16 wasn't as big to be online or to find clients online or to trust you that, I have a Michael that lives in Arizona. I live in New York. Will he do my accounting right, correctly? Because most people at that time would trust their local accountant more than online. Now it's more open, more acceptable. How did you find your clients locally? Was it locally? Was it online? Was it national? What was your approach to finding the clients?
Yeah, so I launched the business in Burlington, Vermont. And that's, my wife is originally from Burlington, Vermont.
So it's not a big state, small state.
Small state. That's the second smallest state in the country, yeah. right? It's very small, 700,000 people, right? And I was in Burlington, which is the largest town, 50,000 people. That's the largest town in the whole state, okay? So I tell people, look, if I can build and launch a national brand from Vermont, you can build it from anywhere, okay?
Exactly.
Right? You can build a national brand from anywhere if you can build it from Vermont. So I first started with obviously launching a website and then leveraging my LinkedIn and my social media presence that I had. It wasn't huge. It was small. Yeah. It wasn't huge, but I leveraged that. And the thing I tell people is if you want people to know what you're doing, you have to tell them, right? So you have to tell everybody. So when I launched Reconciled, I told everybody. I told everybody about it. This is what I'm doing. And I invited people to come on the journey with me, right? To follow me, to come join me as a client. Come join us as a client, join us as a potential employee in the future, come join us as a partner. And I made it the focus to tell everybody I could. And by that time, I had lived in Arizona where I grew up, Seattle, Washington. I lived for a few years with my wife and in our first few years of marriage. And then now Vermont, right? And I hadn't been in Vermont that long, probably 4 or 5 years. And so my networks in each of those places were small to medium size. They weren't huge. And so I just started letting people know. And then people started finding us online. They found us our website or found our social media posts and they found us. The thing that was also happening at the time was QuickBooks Online was growing very fast, but it wasn't huge.
Yeah. No.
You know, but it was growing. It was adding 500,000 to 1 million users a year by that point, right? New users a year. And now I think they add 1 million or 2 million a year. They add a lot of users now. But at the time, it wasn't humongous, and they were still convincing accountants to leave desktop and switch to the cloud. And the product, I think, was still good enough It was, you know, it would serve 80% of the needs, 80% of the businesses out there. It served what you needed. So I also rode the wave of that growth of both QuickBooks Online and then others, the growth of Xero and other products out there that was cloud-based. So I also got very lucky. But you're right. Most buyers, I would say 80% of the small business buyers, 90%, buy accounting services locally. I call it the five handful of services you buy locally: your doctor, your lawyer, your bank, your psychologist, and your accountant. You buy those things locally. Yeah. And my goal was to create a sales and marketing process where I could get somebody I'd never met in person, I'd never met in their town before, in a 30-minute to 1-hour video call. I needed to get them to trust me. And I call that the trust gap. It's like, it's this big gap that you have to fill with trust, and you have to get the buyer to trust you quickly. And most of us do it through relationships in person. We do it through events. We do it through validation. Oh, your cousin uses me. Your best friend uses me. Mm-hmm. Oh, we bank at the same bank. We go to the same, we're part of the same chamber of commerce or country club. That's trust validation. Well, how do you do that virtually? And that's what I had to figure out. And I used the first 2 years of marketing and selling to figure that process out.
So before you started your firm, did you do a content online? Like before you started, were you working elsewhere and doing content and then built this following? Or just when you started, right away, you started doing content? Was it in your mind to, hey, I want to do content online and this is my way approach? Would you read any books? Because you have a, based on what you're saying, like you have a good approach to sales, to conversion, you have processes in place. You were an accountant most of your career. It's not like you were in sales before to learn the stuff.
Right.
How did you, was it something that you learned in prior company you worked at, that you saw the sales in other companies and you want to copy that? Or what made you figure that out on your own? Because in the beginning, you just, things are trial and error. But most accountants don't have this sight to, okay, this is what I'm going to do. How did you, like, what was the initial steps, I would say, that you thought, okay, this is my sales approach? By the way, what was the pricing? Like, what was like the average pricing before? And I know you have your pricing online right now, so I can see those. Was it always been high? Did you like get higher and higher over time? And what was the price around that too?
So great question. So when I first moved to Vermont in 2011, I didn't know anybody except for my wife's family, and they're not in the business community. I decided, okay, I know accounting. I've done accounting in companies. I'm going to just go to networking events and start networking. Try to see if I can pick up any client or work or something, a job, whatever. Just see what's out there.
Hustle.
I went to the first few networking events and I picked up a small client. I just offered to do their books, their bookkeeping on the side, right? So none of this was online. This is all in person, all this stuff I was doing. And I also didn't know the pricing that the market would handle at the time.
Exactly.
As a solo bookkeeper, solo accounting person. So I started really low. I started at $30 an hour, then $40 an hour, then $50. So I kept raising it. As I got new clients, I just kept raising it. And then I eventually shifted. After that first year, that was 2011, 12, I eventually shifted to fixed fee. So I would get clients and go, you know what? Instead of charging hourly, I'm going to just charge you $1,000 a month. I'm going to charge you $2,000 a month, charge you $3,000 a month, depending on what you need from me. So that's when I really learned how to do the fixed fee pricing, right? This is what I think you need. This is how much time I think it's going to take me per week or month. I'm just going to charge you this flat rate. I don't want to track time. I don't want you to worry about time. I'll get the job done.
And at that time, it wasn't, now it's more mainstream to be flat fee. At that time, was it probably why? I'm sure like you push back from clients, or was it, oh, I like this type of service?
I didn't get a lot of pushback. I just was able to explain to them, hey, look, I think this is going to make sense for you and me. It's going to incentivize me to want to do the work more efficiently,
makes
faster,
sense.
And then you're going to get the same result, if not better. And I'm going to be incentivized to want to do more for you because I've got this flat fee and be efficient. So it was helpful, but that was my limited experience in sales. Was just going to networking events, picking up clients like a typical accountant or typical professional services person. When I launched Reconciled that summer of 15, before I launched it, I met with a friend of mine who was a sales professional. She had just lost her job. And I said to her, hey, why don't you start consulting startups? I recommend to her, you should start consulting startups and small businesses on how to do sales, because not a lot of us know how to do sales that start companies. And actually, I'll be your first client. Okay. So I want you to meet with me once a week, starting the summer of 15, like starting May, June 15. And I want you to meet once a week, and I want to start building an actual formal sales process. Because right now I'm just like randomly just going to events and meeting people. But I want a formal sales process. I don't know how to do it. So we started meeting once a week, and she started teaching me like, well, what does it look like to actually do sales formally for a services company? Well, while we were doing that, the idea for Reconciled came about during that process, because I said, wait, selling professional services, the problem is if I scale this, I'm going to run out of time. I'm going to run out of bandwidth myself. I'm not going to be able to scale anything. If this works, I'm going to, you know, get to 6 months from now, be full. And then what do I do now? Like, I can't sell anymore. I'm doing work. So the idea of Reconciled came about, and I said to her, hey, I think there's something else that's more scalable than just selling Michael services as a solo consultant. I think we can build a brand that scales and use the sales process that you've taught me. And so that's how Reconciled was born. And then that's how the idea of a scalable sales process was introduced. But before that, I interacted with the salespeople at the companies I worked with, but I didn't know sales. I didn't do it. It was really trial and error of figuring it out.
That's unique. I think most accountants are scared of sales, mm-hmm. and that's why I end up going the lower price, because they don't have the much value. They can charge higher prices. So it's safer to charge lower prices and not be able to convince through sales steps and processes, hey, this is my value. This is what I can help you with. But you were from the day one, had this insight and had this awareness. And this is what I wanted to build. Now, as the first year go by, second year go by, you're hiring staff to work under you. You're still doing the sales processes, getting clients. Was most of your clients coming through online, like national and not local? That's one. And two, did you teach this process to your other staffs to go also face the new prospects to convert clients?
So at the beginning, I think for 75% or so of my prospects came through my own network, right? So that network could be
like Arizona,
the different places
Seattle,
I had lived locally. Yeah. And then 25% just came through online outreach, website.
Through your content.
Yeah, content. I also, in the second year of business, we also started testing cold email outreach.
Interesting.
So I stumbled upon cold email outreach. I really asked the question, how do other people, other businesses scale that are not professional services, but maybe other industries? So software companies, B2B software has scaled, and they have a history of scaling for the past couple decades, which is cold outreach. They either do cold calling, cold emails, cold social media, or a mix of all of that. And so I figured out, okay, what are the tools that B2B software is using? We're trying to be kind of like that, except we have human beings involved, but we're trying to create an experience that's similar to interacting with more automated software, except we're a service. So cold email outreach, I began researching it and then found a couple of tools to start testing. And we tested that in 2017 and 18 and landed on cold email outreach as a way we would continue to accelerate leads. And that has become the top. But so quickly it flipped from 75% local network and referrals, 25% online, to almost 100% email outreach and online. And basically, I barely rely on my local network. Now, of course, do we still get referrals and everything? Yes. But the outreach is literally 90%+ or almost 100% of the leads we get. It's just cold email outreach and our online presence now. Because we've been in business for 8 years, but by year 4 or 5, it was all that. It was almost all that. I didn't have to rely on anything local.
Wow, that's impressive. At that time, social media was just getting going. And so with the email outreach, did you like specifically choose a niche, like industry to go after? Did you have a leverage in certain industries that you can relate to clients and say, okay, I'll charge you more for this because I blah, blah, blah? Was it just entrepreneurs, period?
Yeah, you know, when you do cold email outreach, the most effective way to do it is you have to target a demographic of people or demographic profile of the business. So we really targeted campaigns in specific regions, and we went industry by industry to see what would work and what messaging would work and not work. And so we did a lot of outreach with multi-channel e-commerce, a lot of outreach to manufacturing companies, outreach to professional services companies, digital marketing agencies, a lot of outreach to alcohol and drink makers.
Beverage.
But we avoided restaurant owners. We avoided retail store, small companies with high volume. We really targeted those that we felt like the profile of the owner would fit well in outsourcing their accounting mm-hmm. services. And then as we got clients and we learned more and more, and as the profiles of our clients became clear, then we started targeting similar types of companies in our campaigns. And that helped a lot.
Wow. So when you grew from one by yourself and then you hired accountants right away to do bookkeeping for you, was it local accountants? Was it national accountants, different states? Was it outsourced from the beginning? What was your approach in hiring a team? How many team members do you have currently?
We have about 50 people 50. In the U.S. and in Argentina as well.
Oh, so you want South America?
Yeah, South America. Yeah.
Okay. Because most people go to the Philippines or India.
Yeah, no, we're not in the India or the Philippines. We're not in Asia. We're in South America. I'm really bullish on the Spanish speaking countries, which is great. I think they're great. But they make up about a quarter of our team, but the three quarters is in the US.
From the 50, a quarter is from South America or 50 plus?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, a quarter of those is South America. Yeah. So when I started with the Burlington area where I was, I had a small little office. And I always gave an option for people to work from home, but it was basically hybrid. It was basically hybrid. Just, you know, hey, I'm going to hire you in the local area. Come in if you need to. I'm here at this local office. I couldn't afford a big office or anything. So I just had a little office and people could come if they wanted to otherwise work from home. And then just expanded out from there is once I ran out of good candidates, then I spread it out to the whole state and just said, hey, you can work remotely. Then I spread it out to neighboring states. And then eventually across the country. So it was methodical, my approach. But now we do across the country and in South America right now, predominantly Argentina.
I like that. Argentina, kind of with the currency crisis, probably, you probably get the same rates as Philippines.
Super helpful, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting, man. Interesting. And so my question on a sale, and like, did you teach this process within your team to convert other prospects? That do you still do the sales, or you have now your team members doing all the sales conversion?
I hired my first salesperson in early 2018. Third year in the business, and taught them the process. And then we started growing a sales team. And now I don't have to get involved in sales anymore.
Did that person have a accounting background, or just he was just sales?
No. Sales background.
I just thought
my recommendation is in sales is the best salespeople are the best salespeople. They don't have to have the background in your industry. They just need to have the best sales skills.
So was it like a full-time job? Was it commission-based?
It's full-time based and commission like any other sales job. Yeah, and that's what we have still today is we have salespeople with full-time base and commission incentives.
That's impressive. I mean, I'm scared to hire a sales guy because, you know, I can convert clients. And that's a good, I think, good step to take for a lot of accountants and a lot of CPA firms or a lot of firms that own a practice is as the owner, you have certain sales skills. A lot of firms that grow are somewhat good at sales. You can't grow without being good at sales. But I think we have to, at some point, say, okay, I'm not the best salesperson. I can get somebody that's full-time sales and convert better than me. Now, where the gray area comes about, was your sales guy doing 10 calls a day, 20 calls a week? Okay, how many calls was he doing to maybe make it worth the full-time job? Because he won't be sitting on his butt, I mean, doing nothing if the pipeline's not full and he has getting a lot of leads in the door.
That's the difference between us and most other accounting firms is because we were doing cold email outreach at volume and filling leads in a funnel, we have plenty of room for sales calls and time to do the sales proposals and sales prospecting. If you don't have a process to do marketing and mm-hmm. outreach, then yeah, you're wasting your time. On the other side is, I think the fallacy that most accounting firm owners have about themselves is they think they're the best at everything. So
if
you meet an accounting firm owner, I've yet to meet an accountant that doesn't think they're the best accountant that for their clients, which is impossible because there's a bell curve. So that means there's a bell curve in accounting. That means most accountants are average at best, if not below average. Most are not above average, right? So no, you're not the best accountant. But, and then also I've yet to meet an accountant that thinks that someone else can sell their services. Of course, someone else can sell your services. It's not the most complicated thing to sell in the world. There are people selling Boeing planes and other more complicated products and services than accounting out there. You think somebody can't sell accounting services? Are you kidding me?
Exactly.
So there's a mix of like almost like naivety around what selling is and also almost like a pride. What I sell is so unique. It's like, no, it's not that unique. And accountants have to admit accounting services in almost all areas is a commodity service. Just like buying a plane ticket is a commodity service. Going to a restaurant is a commodity service. Now, are there extraordinary experiences at restaurants? Yes.
Or high-end restaurants, yeah.
Yeah. Or if exploring experience on a plane, yes, there are. But those are the exceptions. They're not the norms, right? Not every plane flight is a first-class experience. Not every restaurant is going to be a first-class experience. And not everybody can afford that.
100%.
So I think most accountants just have a hard time admitting, I need help in these areas.
That's why most firms is like a majority of accounting firms in the industry are a one-man show.
They're small. They're super small.
They're two, three people firms. They're not big. And
they basically, most firms are a job for the owner. That's what it is. Just, it's not a business. It's just a job that you happen to own.
100%.
You created a job that owns you now, right? That's what accountants have done. Because a lot of, if you talk to them, they're like, oh, I'm stuck. I've got tax season. I'm stuck. My life is stuck in a room 12, 18 hours a day for the next 4 months. And if that's what they want, that's fine. There's nothing like wrong with that. But to do the comparison, it's honestly no different than how is that different than a rideshare driver that has to drive to make money? It's no different.
A little bit more, exactly.
Yeah, it's just no different. There is no difference. And the only main difference is rideshare drivers, their tax season is nights and weekends where they make the most money, right? Uh-huh. If you think about it, for accountants, it's the tax season for a lot of them. But then there's nothing to sell. After that, they have nothing to sell. They don't have a business to sell because they're done. They don't have staff. Yeah. They don't have marketing.
Well,
they don't
have a brand. They're so exhausted after tax season.
Yeah.
They just don't want.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's nothing to buy. So like if you grew it, it's like, well, what am I buying from you? Because you're done working. You're retiring. You're tired. And so that's what most accounting firms are, is they're not real businesses. They're really a job for the owner.
And I look to either be passive eventually or sell it eventually. Like sometimes I think the initial mindset shift in entrepreneurs is that when you start a business, is your intention is to build it, sell it, or eventually come out from be passive, somewhat passive. And I think every person, their approach, if they don't have a plan initially to do that, they become an employee of the company forever. And it looks like you had a different approach. 2 years into the firm, you had a salesperson. So is your dream or your plan or your goal eventually to sell the firm or to build it eventually and be passive 100%? Like, what's like your long-term goal?
My goal, I'm an entrepreneur at heart. So my goal has always been to build and sell and not be, I don't plan on retiring as the CEO in my 60s and have this thing forever. So that's ultimately what I set out to do from the beginning, is to build a brand that could eventually be sellable one day. And however long that takes, I want it to be sellable one day.
You have a magic number? 50 million? 100 million?
I don't know if I have a magic number. It's not that much money. I don't even know what I would do. My lifestyle really hasn't changed much from when I started to now. And, you know, now we're doing several million dollars a year of revenue. We have hundreds and hundreds of clients throughout the country. So my lifestyle hasn't changed really at all. I'm content. I'm happy and content with my lifestyle. And so it's not really about the money. It's about what I get to build and the journey gets beyond. But as an entrepreneur, I love starting new things. And I love growth. And I love being in a growth phase and excitement. Some of the other things that has kept the journey exciting for me is we've spent the past 3 years acquiring other accounting firms, smaller firms, and then integrating them into our model.
Okay.
Yeah. So we've done three so far in the past 3 years. And we're trying to accomplish our fourth one now.
What were these firms certain size? Because so to be honest with you, I've been looking to buy a firm for the past 5 years. And I grew my firm over $1 million in three and a half years. But I haven't found a firm that is good enough. And based on the fees, have bad fees, or they don't have a team. So it's like, is it either or? If they have good fees, but don't have a team, which is okay, the owner's doing all the work, or they have a good team, but they have bad fees. They have a decent team, not a good team, a decent team. You have a CPA and an accountant, senior accountant and stuff like that. But that was biggest thing, like turnoff for me. Every time I look at a firm to buy, and the third problem they have is that low cash flow. So they have a good pricing, good team, no cash flow. And then usually firms are sold based on revenue, not based on cash flow. So now, okay, you're doing $200,000 in cash flow and you want to sell it for $2.2 million. That's 10x. How's that fit? And usually brokers that want to do this stuff, like they just want to based on revenue and they don't care about cash flow. How did you go about, would you go through brokers? You find them online? What was the process initially? What was the revenue threshold that you want to target for? Like, was the minimum, maximum you want with it?
Yeah. So for the first three, I targeted firms doing over $750,000 a year in revenue. So I knew that there would be staff, right? Size enough to there's some staff doing most of the work and that the owner is either just doing sales or maybe reviewing and signing taxes. That was the focus. On average, each of the three firms we bought were around $1 million on average each in revenue.
What was the cash flow?
Anywhere from... anywhere from $200,000 to $400,000 a year on average. Yeah. So, you know, if you think of the average, $300,000 a year on cash flow. And I was able to pick up the firms on average about 1x revenue.
Okay.
So, yeah. That's so you're talking about, you know, 3 to 4x times cash flow, right? That's your focus. Like I said before, most firms out there that you're going to look at are too small and they're not great businesses to buy. They're just jobs. I'm not surprised. Yeah, you're going to find a lot of firms that are the owners doing all the billings. You're going to find, that's what you're going to find, a lot of firms like that. You have to go up market to get to a size where you can see that their staff, and then you can start ranking other things like cash flow, average billing per client per month, or if it's a tax-focused firm, average billing per return, and really honing in on the criteria that you're looking for to focus on. There are some firms where the owner is young enough to where maybe they just hate being on their own and that's why they haven't grown. Maybe they actually be a great acqui-hire so that they would be a great addition to your team and you can sell them the idea of you growing the practice while they just are a great individual contributor. So there's opportunities there for buying firms through acqui-hiring and then that way you get good talent as well. So that's also a strategy that you know, that's possible. I haven't done that myself. That's not really why I'm in it, but there's a lot of firms doing under $500,000 a year. And again, that's going to be one, two people often. So that's too small to do, I think, too small and doesn't justify the legal expenses to go through to buy that practice. But if you do acqui-hire or if you go work there as somebody who wants to eventually own that firm, go work there and then make an agreement with the owner that you want to take over someday. There's things like that.
Solar finance. I know when you bought those three firms, it wasn't all rosy and smooth.
Of course not. Of course not.
And you did it three times. So like you're stubborn enough to go through it because a lot of people get scared after one purchase. And that's, I think, that what separates successful entrepreneurs. They're just, you move forward. All right. And even though they have bumps along the road and stuff like that, but they still move forward. What things if you look back, say, hey, I should have done this XYZ. If somebody is looking to buy a firm, right, what's your kind of advice?
If you're looking to buy your first firm, which most people don't end up buying one, So first you got to get over the fear of just buying one. Mm-hmm. And buying one firm is not going to be a great representation of
you.
The buying experience for everybody. It's just your one experience.
Exactly.
Now I've got three in my hand, so I have a pretty good sample size of buying. But even then, I'm only buying at a certain size. So what I'm buying doesn't represent what buying a $5 million firm is probably like.
Or and you're buying something that you already, you had a firm is already established, so you can, it's easy to, well, it's easy, not easier, but you have a firm.
I have a firm. Yeah, I have a firm. Exactly. Yeah. I'm not just somebody working at an accounting firm and trying to leave to buy a firm, right? So it's also a different experience as well.
Exactly.
I have a team that's helping me and all that stuff. So if like most people that are probably listening, they're accountants at a firm, or maybe they have a small firm themselves. So my recommendation is get help. Work with a buying broker, work with a good M&A attorney, and work with a solid banker that knows the accounting space, right? Those three things are going to be helpful. And then reach out to me, reach out to somebody who's bought a firm or
exactly.
who's bought a few firms and have them walk you through that process. You can even ask the person that you're working with to help you find a firm. You can ask them, who else have you helped? Can you introduce me? I'd like their advice, right? It's not hard to do that. So you can do that. And you'd be surprised. Most accountants want to help other accountants.
They exactly.
They don't want their fellow accountants to go through the same mistakes. So most are very helpful. I got a lot of help and I got a lot of advice from a lot of people during the process.
Do you recommend buying or starting?
Buying or starting? I don't know if it's either or, but in this market right now.
So you started and you bought.
Yeah.
You were successful also when you started. It's not like you were like not successful when you started.
Correct.
Your own firm.
Correct.
So you were successful enough to start your own firm and build it to seven figures.
Yeah.
And then you bought seven figure firms. So it's a unique perspective, right, to have.
Yeah.
What would you recommend?
It really depends on your goals. Because if your goal is to build a big brand like me, then you want to start off at least thinking through what your firm is going to be like, what you want to do. Because when you buy somebody else's firm, you're buying somebody else's established culture as well.
Exactly.
And you're buying somebody else's brand name to start off with. And you either need to align with all those things and see what changes you can make to that, which are going to be few. But otherwise, starting out, it's the cheapest it's ever been to start an accounting firm. The demand for services is out there. And you know you're going to be able to find work. The hard part for most accountants is most accountants will just end up finding the work that they can do and they will fill up their calendars and then they will never grow outside of that. Because look at the history of accounting firms. That's what happens. If your goal is that, if your goal is to just find enough work to keep yourself busy and happy and make it a job so that you call the shots, great. That's the goal. I would start a firm, right? If that's your goal. If your goal is to build a business and grow a brand, then buying a firm is going to be a great leg up, mainly because you'll have clients and staff right away. But just know that you're going to want to buy one where you really believe you can resonate with the culture alignment. Otherwise, you might want to start from scratch. And while you're building clients, go buy one to add to your process. So I know people who've bought right out the gate and then started building slowly. And then I know like myself and others who have built first and then after a number of years went out and bought. It really isn't no right answer. It depends on what you're trying to do.
Yeah. It's a pickle. You're in the middle trying to, I think is starting is a lot easier. You have no down payment. You're buying a laptop.
Yeah.
And that's it.
It's
that's
real
your
simple.
Initial investment. The no risk at all. And you just have to figure out the social media game and figure out content, how it works and what you want to do. But yeah, I think the other skills, the leadership skills, the management skills, buying a firm right away, if you already manage your product, it's easier. Like at a level manager where you worked at before, either at a public accounting firm or a private industry. But yeah, I see where you're moving. Any last words, any advice for new accountants, new entrepreneurs that want to start by maybe work with you, work for you? Because you mentioned that you have a program once a year, accountants gather.
Yeah, at the end of April, after tax season is over, I just invite a bunch of accounting firm owner friends to come and join me and my friends in Scottsdale, Arizona. And so I find a hotel that we all gather at, and it's really R&R. There's no program, there's no schedule, there's no fee. You just come and hang out. So if there's any accountants that are listening and they're firm owners and they want to come, or anybody in the industry that like to come, just reach out to me and happy to send you an invite.
Cool. Cool. All right, man. Thanks. It was a nice call. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks, Bilal.
Want to stay connected with us beyond the podcast?
You can find us on LinkedIn to keep the conversation going, ask questions, and stay updated on the latest in the accounting world.
Head over there to share your greatest takeaway from today's conversation. We love to hear from you.